unofficially start the hearing. We don't have a quorum present yet, so we will get together as a cordial group of folks to chat until we get the quorum. But we like to start on time, and so welcome to the bonding committee. Today we're going to hear a couple of presentations, both of them in the area of higher education. The first is from our friends at Minsky. And I see the chancellor's here. Thank you very much. And with that, I'll probably stop yakking and turn it over to you folks to give us maybe an overview of your request, but also maybe tell us a little bit about what took your dollars from last year. Thank you, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chair Dorman and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim McCormick, and I have the privilege of serving Minnesota as the chancellor of the state college and university system. I want you to know we got the word. The longer we talk, probably the less we get. So we're going to be very respectful of that. We have a number of our college and university presidents here today, and I would like them to stand, and I appreciate them being here to be supportive. Our presidents, please. Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to talk with the committee today about our capital budget request, which is summarized in the publication Space to Learn, Shaping Minnesota's Future. For the benefit of the committee, I would like to begin by giving a very brief overview of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We are a diverse network of 32 colleges and universities committed to meeting the needs of the people of Minnesota. We are the largest provider of higher education in the state, providing access to higher education opportunity on 53 campuses in 46 Minnesota communities. We serve about 370,000 students per year, 240,000 in credit-based courses, and an additional 130,000 in non-credit courses. We serve 61% of the state's undergraduates, about four times as many as the private colleges or the University of Minnesota. To serve these 61%? Students...
61%?
Right. 61.
Got it.
To serve these students and provide them with high-quality educational service, we need to have well-maintained and up-to-date facilities. Our request is for $280.4 million for 27 capital projects located throughout the state. Every state college and university in the system will benefit from these projects, which will improve learning spaces and services to students. The request you have before you is the product of an intensive 18-month process involving our Board of Trustees, the college and university presidents, and many staff members who review these projects. Our request is grounded on the system's strategic plan, first adopted in 2002 and updated this year. We use the plan's four strategic directions as guidelines by which to evaluate the proposals that came forward: access, quality, meeting state economic needs, and innovation. Like the legislature, our board receives more proposals than can be handled. Requests for 68 capital projects and 394 repair and replacement projects for more than $550 million were submitted by the colleges and universities. Through our rigorous process, the list was trimmed and priorities determined. Our Board of Trustees believes that this is an investment in the future of our great state. They take very seriously their responsibility to be good stewards of our existing assets and to protect the previous investments made by state taxpayers. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would like to thank you for the time you have spent looking at these projects. I know that you have spent together hundreds of hours visiting with proposed projects all over the state, and I know that your presence was greatly appreciated by our students, our faculty, our staff, and the community members. This really means so much for you to get out there. We also are very grateful for last year's bonding bill, and we thank you for your very strong support. Just a word about the governor's bonding recommendation. While we believe his recommendation was a good start, it will not surprise you to know that we think the overall recommendation falls considerably short of our needs. We are very concerned that the governor recommended only $20 million of the $110 million we requested for asset preservation. Our repair and replacement projects and, the board's top priority. We believe funding asset preservation at a low level would be a huge mistake that would adversely affect our students and our system for years to come. Mr. Chair and members, if you look at the 27 projects on our priority list, you will find an emphasis on projects that will help the colleges and universities expand their capacity to educate healthcare professionals and make improvements in laboratories and science facilities. We believe this is a forward-looking request and will keep our students warm, safe, and dry, and help this great state be competitive. Now, here to tell you about the bonding projects, for just a very few minutes, is Associate Vice Chancellor Alan Johnson. We will keep our remarks short to allow time to respond to you with your various questions. Al?
Thank you, Chancellor. Mr. Chairman, good afternoon, and members. The Chancellor gets to show the nice picture. I get to talk about HEPR. The budget we have before you this afternoon finds its roots in what we have set out as a first part of a 10-year plan to reinvest in our facilities. And you see here for the 06-07 biennium, that plan includes $110 million in HEPR, $74 million of renewal projects that are embedded in the capital project list, but also $40 million of campus operating funds. Campuses are stepping up to the plate and becoming a partner here with the capital process in order to renew and to repair facilities. This does not include new space, mind you, just the renewal of existing space. And so the budget then, bearing in mind those two numbers I used just on the earlier slide of $110 million for HEPR and $74 million in capital renewal projects, also includes $76 million in new construction, $1.6 million in demolition of obsolete facilities, a strategic property acquisition project at $11.4 million, and to design projects for the 08 biennium at $7 million, totaling $280.4 million. The $280 million budget by project can be seen in the booklet that the Chancellor mentioned that is at your place, the Space to Learn. This is the Governor's recommendations out of the $110 million in HEPR. As the Chancellor mentioned, the Governor recommended only 20. The Governor also skipped over projects number 5, 6, 12, and 13, and skipped the demolition project number 16. He did recommend partially funding the property acquisition project and then skipped all projects 18 through 27.
Mr. Jansky, hold for a second. You want to ask your question now,
yes, Mr. Chair? It deals with HEPR.
Oh, you know, while I'm already yakking, we'll call the meeting to order as well.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, Chancellor, first of all, I want to thank you. At the last meeting, I had requested a list of how you would spend the $20 million if that was the number that Minsky would receive in the final bill on HEPR projects, and you provided that list within 5 days, so I thank you very much. I would encourage the members to take a look at the list. The list is very telling. When you take a look at campuses such as Mankato and St. Cloud, the number would be zero at $20 million in HEPR, which would mean that at least four or five roofs in each campus that are leaking now would not be repaired. You have 40-year-old ventilating and heating systems that would not be repaired. So that the $20 million is an extraordinary number when we're looking at campuses that would receive either a new building or a new addition, and then around it would have buildings that would have leaky roofs, for instance. So I would encourage this committee to seriously look at increasing the HEPR number. By the way, I would also encourage not to take it away from new construction, but to just make the bill larger so that HEPR would expand. But my point is, again, that at the governor's number, while it's nice to be there when you're breaking ground for a new building, I think if you look on some of these campuses to your left and to your right, you would probably have buildings that would have leaky roofs, which I think is unacceptable.
Thank you. Please continue.
Continuing on, to compare the governor's the governor's recommendation with the request, you see here the $20 million and the difference between the 170 for projects in the request and the governor's recommendation of 122. I think it's also important to remember that the system, in particular the colleges and universities, are a partnership here, and that we fund together what's known as user financing. Under our request, $56 million would come out of college and university operating budgets, that would go towards paying the one-third debt service, leaving a net bonding request of 224. And those are the numbers that you'll see on your spreadsheets as the bill develops. But if you would bear in mind that one-third debt service is a very real part of the system's operating budget. This compares the governor's recommendation a little bit further. You can see that while recommending $140 million out of $280 looks like 51%, when you're at the net line, you're actually comparing $101 million to $224, or 45%. And it's not as good as it looks at the onset. You had asked about our spending rates for last year. This is a graph of the 2005 projects. This does not include HEPR in this slide. The continuous S curve in the middle is our planned execution curve. The blue line to the left shows that after 1 year, since that appropriation, we have 65% of the appropriation under contract, or $110 million, spending money out the door. That lower line, 22% of that appropriation has been actually spent, or $35 million. It's a little bit slower than we would have liked, but we had three projects that had to go out for rebid because of the bids coming in higher due to unanticipated inflation. On the HEPR side of the equation, this is a much shorter time plan. Several years ago, we promised that we would commit all HEPR funds given to us within 2 years, and so that S-curve goes to actually to March of 07. And here we are in March of 06, 1 year after having received that appropriation. We have 70% of that appropriation under contract. That's $29 million, and 43% of it spent, about $18 million out the door. The balance of that is ready for this coming construction season, primarily in roof replacements, and so we feel very good about hitting our 2-year commitment rate.
If I could ask a question there, for understanding that 70% of your 2005 HEPR allocation is under contract, so you have 30% that you just haven't, you know, let the bids or let the contract go? Is that?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. You know, we plan, for example, roofs. In that first construction season, we don't try to do all the roofs all at once. It would be a big load on the construction industry, for one thing. And so we always plan to do some design in that first year, and then this other 30% that you talked about will be out for bid here within the next month or two. All going to meet our commitment to having everything committed by this time next year.
So it's fair to say that you will be out to bid with almost 100% of it by the time we get done with this bill.
By late spring, by May, June, yes.
Thank you.
Just briefly, in the interest of time, I'll run through the projects, starting first with HEPR as the number one priority. You've heard the definition many times. It is, as the Chancellor mentioned, the board's first priority, and it is outlined in our publication on page one. The campuses submitted this year 394 HEPR projects valued at $240 million. The board's budget of $110 million includes 165 HEPR projects. And so we did some winnowing down in order to bring this 110 into the budget. The budget has been allocated by campus, and you can see that on page two, little I, in the front overleaf of the booklet, where you can see that a full funding of $110 million, how much would go to each campus. The allocation of that HEPR, once again, a third of it is going towards roof replacements around the system, a third towards replacement of aged heating, ventilating, and air conditioning equipment. And the balance, as you see there on the chart. If we fund HEPR, if you're able to fund HEPR this year, HEPR saves energy. There's no question about that. For one thing, when we replace a roof, we double the installation value. We exceed the state energy code. We have anecdotal and actual evidence that we can save up to 50% of energy use in a particular space just by replacing a roof eliminating moisture intrusion into the building. Mechanical systems will save money as well. $350,000 is a conservative estimate just on improving efficiencies that are in this $110 million HEPA request. Overall, in the HEPA request, if you added all the savings together, we're looking at about $850,000 per year that this HEPA program would save in operating costs. The $20 million, as recommended by the governor, if we had to live with that, $17 million of that would go into roof replacements for the most urgent roofs, and $3 million into infrastructure and heating, ventilating, and air conditioning. That would still leave a considerable number of roofs that are leaking, that are deteriorating, and are in a failure mode. And then just briefly to run through each project, and you can follow along in the order of the projects in our book. Priority number 2 at Minnesota State University Mankato, starting on page 2 of the booklet. Priority 3 on phase 3 and so on. Number 2 is the Traft and Science Center building addition and renovation. The request is for $32.9 million. Design was funded in 2005 by the legislature at $2.6 million. Number 3 at St. Cloud State, the WIC Science Building addition and renovation for $14 million. That design was also funded last year for $900,000. Century College is number 4 for a science and library building at $19.9 million. It too was funded for design in 05. Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College is number 5, $12.4 million for a multi-purpose building and library expansion. That design was also funded last year. Number 6 at Minnesota State University Moorhead, McLean Hall renovation, $9.7 million. That design has been funded in the last session. Number 7, Minneapolis Community and Technical College, Science and Allied Health renovations, $18.9 million. That design was funded in 05, and that goes to the renovation of one of the old Billy Graham properties on Hennepin Avenue in downtown Minneapolis. St. Paul College is number 8. Design of applied lab renovations, which would take place in 08, and the about 2.5 out of that $3 million towards replacement of the electrical distribution system for the college. Number 9 of Bemidji State University, a science addition and renovation at Satcast Hall. The request is for design money this year for $700,000. Number 10 at Minnesota State College Southeast Technical at Red Wing, renovations of that campus. The design was funded in 03, and with the request for 06 is $4.9 million. Number 11 at Norbondale Community College, classroom addition and renovation. Phase 1 would be accomplished in 2006 for $5.1 million, and a Phase 2 in 08 for $5.3 million. Number 12 at Inverhills Community College, an addition and renovation. This too is requested for design in 06 at $700,000. Number 13 at St. Cloud State University, the renovation of Riverview Hall. Design has already been funded, and this would, at $4.5 million, undertake the renovation of one of two buildings in our system that are on the National Register of Historic Places. Winona State University is number 14, Maxwell Hall renovation, the old library. Design was funded several years ago and is now in for construction at $11.2 million. Number 15, one of the projects that the governor did recommend, is for system-wide science and lab renovations at 10 campuses for $5.1 million. These are small $400,000 to $500,000 projects at each campus. Number 16 is demolition. We would demolish 130,000 square feet on 5 campuses at $1.7 million. Number 17 is a strategic property acquisition project at 5 campuses, as well as a system-wide pool for future opportunities. Those properties include $2 million at Bemidji State University to acquire school district land, prior school district land, $3.45 million at Dakota County Technical College to acquire 105 acres currently owned by the University of Minnesota, $1.1 million at Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College to acquire 6 properties that are right adjacent to their property line, $400,000 at Northeast Higher Education District, Vermilion Community College in Ely. $3.4 million at St. Cloud Technical College to acquire a Health Partners building that is adjacent to their campus. And then, as I indicated, $1 million for a system-wide pool for unique land acquisition opportunities as they become available. Number 18 is North Hennepin Community College, a building addition and renovation. It is requested for design at $700,000. Number 19, at Northland Community and Technical College, the East Grand Forks campus, and a small addition and renovations, also requesting design for $600,000. Number 20, back to Minnesota State University Moorhead, this time Lohman Hall addition. A very small addition, and primarily a renovation of this 1930 vintage building, $600,000 for design in 06. Number 21, Lake Superior College in Duluth, the health and science addition, design funds for $840,000. Number 22, Metropolitan State University in St. Paul, a classroom building for $4.9 million. Number 23 and number 24 are law enforcement centers, both requesting design money this year. Alexandria Technical College, a law enforcement, as well as a technical lab renovation, $840,000 for design. And number 24, Metropolitan State University and Minneapolis Community and Technical College to design a law enforcement center that will actually be on the campus of Hennepin Technical College in Brooklyn Park at $700,000. Number 25, Mesabi Range Community and Technical College, the Eveleth campus. This is for renovations of their technical labs into a small building addition that would bring two programs onto campus where the students could avail themselves of student support services for $4.3 million. Number 26 at Southwest Minnesota State University, science labs and restaurant lab renovations, designed at $500,000 for 06. And number 27, a unique project at Winona State University, Memorial Hall expansion and renovation. We're asking for design money of $400,000, which will be added to revenue fund dollars of $300,000+ for design this year, anticipating this mixed funded project in 2008.
We're ready for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Are there questions or witty comments from members?
No one's made an elevator joke about Winona yet.
Representative Pulowski.
Mr. Chair, no, I'm not going to go with that. I bet was in the elevator. It was no joke.
Cranky security help, too.
Yes, and the chair. Although the chair, I could tell you a story about the chair and the security officer in that conversation, but it would take too much time here, but it's a fascinating story. Mr. Chair, I'm going to just ask a couple questions about number 27. On number 27, this is the Winona State project. You've got $3.1 million in private funds, so you've got three different types of funding sources here. Assuming that the $400,000 would be available this year, the construction date is 2008. If that project isn't funded, can you tell me how long the $3.1 million is available?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pulaski, I don't know the commitments on the different funding streams for that private money. I'm sorry, I can get that to you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, I appreciate it, because if we don't fund it and the 3.1 isn't available, then could you tell me, would Winona State push forward on this, and would we slide that money either into revenue bonds or GO bonds?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pulaski, I frankly don't know the answer to that question. We'd have to do some research on it.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, I'm going to go for question three. How many projects does Minsky have where you have a mix like this of GO, private funds, and revenue bonds?
Mr. Johnson.
I only see one on this list, but in the past, how many do you have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pulaski, this is the only one of this three-part mix. We have some with two parts, but this is a three-part mix.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, is that why it's ranked 27 then, because it's so unique?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pulaski, I think it's rated 27 because it is unique and because it made the list.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, if the information would come forward the 3.1 million is not available past a certain date. Would that change the Minsky ranking on this project?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pulaski, I can't speak for the board. We would probably take that information to the Board of Trustees.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, you were really good about getting me information at the last meeting. If you could get it to me just a little faster this time, I would be very interested in the answers on this particular project, not just because I represent Winona, but I anticipate that we may have projects in the future that will have this type of a mix on our other campuses, and I'd be intrigued by how Minsky responds in the future to these types of projects, particularly if there is a very, very short timeline on the private funding street.
You know, Mr. Johnson, and I should answer this or not, but when you put together a priority list, do you look at that? I mean, because we get a lot of projects, whether it's, you know, some of the university projects or other projects that say, you know, jeepers, it's got to be, you know, we have to have it because we've got this private money out there. That come into your factor at all, or do you rank these based on solely on the need for the building versus other buildings? It's a tough call because, I mean, I understand everybody wants to keep those private dollars if you can get them, yet, you know, if you need a building somewhere else, you need a building.
Mr. Chairman, we do take into account private, other people's money, whether it be donations or it be grant money and things of that nature. What we did learn in this process is that we need to look at it in a broader way. What we see in the future is going to be, it's going to include projects, more projects of this type where other money has to come in. And so there has to be a better recognition in the future.
Sure. Representative Dean has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, first of all, I just want to commend you on a very, very good plan and also for the tours this summer. And it was very informative, good presentation, and also continuing on into here. Very impressive. Both in the selection of projects and also the way they have been communicated. So I want to just say that right away. Looking at the number, the big heaper number that we've looked at also has been communicated, and also thank you for providing the additional detail on the $20 million expenditure. So as this committee looks at that very big heaper number and we start to chew and chisel on that, looking at this prioritization, just wondering how that prioritization of heaper breaks down from your point of view, both per facility and also per unit. For example, life safety is a portion that I see within the heaper. Does that have a higher priority over energy savings, or how do you prioritize the heaper number within that, either by definition, by building section, or by location, or by dollar amounts? How do you approach that?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, we start first by asking each president, what are your HEPA priorities? No one knows the campus better than the campus president and the campus facilities people. And we say, what is your first priority? What is your second, third? Depending on the campus, it could go for, you know, 20, 25 different projects. And so we start with that. And then in the dialogue and then with reviewing documents, we determine what are the criticalities? What are the most critical projects? So, for example, some college might have a leaking roof that has failed as its number one priority, and its neighbor may have something that's less critical, and so we have to weigh that in the ultimate decision if the 110, for example, goes down to 90 or 80 or something like that. So we start out with the priorities of every school, looking and learning at the criticalities of each of those projects. And we do that by dialogue with the schools and by being out on the campuses. We don't sit in our offices here in St. Paul. We go out to campuses and understand what their criticalities are and what their problems are and try to make that decision, which roof is in worse shape, which boiler is in worse shape.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
When you are, so It's basically on a facility by facility basis that you distribute the HEPR dollars, and I think that was the answer to the question I was looking for. I do know that every one of us who owns a house knows that our maintenance needs are always larger than we always want to build onto our house rather than take care of what we have, and it's always tempting to do that, but it's also a lot of these needs are very necessary and probably do deserve more attention than what we have seen so far. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, we had a bit of a discussion about this, and I think Representative Pawlowski raised it, so I'm going to raise it on the record today, and I think it goes for the university as well. I am concerned about what policy Minsky will set for how a project that's needed, its participation with private funds. And, you know, not every campus is equal in terms of its history of private donations or private fundraising. And some people may say, well, that's all too bad. You better go out and hustle harder than presidents or whoever. But I do think that as you go down this path and as this becomes a bigger mix, we need to be in constant dialogue about how that is going to appear in these great books where you prioritize what your needs are, because I'm also worried about colleges that don't have that history or departments that don't have that history. In the case of the U, where you may not have someone who has the sort of private resources to, let's say, prime the pump to make sure that a project moves along. And so I am very curious about how this is going to be handled going forward. I don't think this is a issue just today. I think this is an issue for the next 20 years or next 30 years or 50 years for us of how we're going to be able to, you know, adequately address the needs of the system when not everyone is going to have equal access to private money. So I don't know if you can speak to that today or if that's something that later on. I just know that for years some colleges toiled and had a very difficult time in this process, and they did not have the sort of private resources available to them.
Mr. Chair and Chancellor, Representative, I think you raise, you and Representative Plofsky raise an important issue for the board and for all of us to consider. Remember, though, our vision and the expectation is that we would enable all Minnesotans to succeed with the most access and the most highly valued education. So I think we have to start with serving the people of the state of Minnesota in a very fair way. And while we need to sort this through, I think there could be cases where you might have a building that's almost free, that is private funding, and you still may not want to do it because you didn't need it, it didn't fit the needs, because once it's built, you still have to provide for it, heat it, and all of that. So I think it's a factor, but not the only factor. And I think we'd have to be careful in terms of taking care of all of our citizens, to be very fair and very thoughtful about that. And I think you raised the question. We've not had a lot of this, but I think we're going to have more, and we'll need to sort that out. But I would want to say to all of you now, it's a thoughtful, analytical decision, not one because you have the money, you ought to do it, necessarily, if you didn't have the need, if it didn't pass all of the other tests. And but I think it ought to be a factor. And what could be a factor in this limited time, suppose you had a $10 million project or 15, what would be wonderful is if it were our number 10 project or number 1 project and you could get $5 million toward the 15, which gets the objectives met, at the same time gives more money to other institutions on down the line because you've been able to raise it. And so I think it's a good question. We'll take it under careful consideration. And this is part of the change that's going on. And we are much more, and the presidents are here, we're much more aggressive in terms of trying to raise funds. And we want to give every president the signal that they need to work at this, because obviously there's not enough money to do all the things we need to do. So we want to incent them to do it. On the other hand, we have to look out for the fairness of all Minnesotans, because if you take a project that's less need and you fund it, then some others will not be funded. Thank you for the question, and I look forward to more discussion with the committee, Mr. Chair, as time goes on.
Thank you. Members, do you have... Representative Murphy is on the list. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Councilor Johnson, were you consulted by the governor's office when they were making out their list of recommendations?
Representative Murphy.
Here's the tough question.
We were given the opportunity at one point, representing the board, to have a discussion with the governor's staff about our program, at which time we presented it. I was not consulted, and to the best of my knowledge, the board was not consulted about what his decisions were. But we did have the opportunity to make a presentation to the staff.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy,
the presentation was made before he started his deliberations?
Well, we don't know just... Mr. Chair, we don't, and Representative Murphy, we just don't know when he started, but we did have several weeks before he announced his recommendations. Several weeks before that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor McCormick, does each of the institutions have a foundation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, these are being developed. Most of them do, but not all of the two-year colleges, but they're being developed, and we're encouraging all of them to develop a foundation to help raise money to support the college and the university.
And Mr. Chair, Chancellor McCormick, when you say to support the college and the university, do you mean financial support for programming or for extras, or will it eventually come to... supporting the university or the college for
capital bonding? Chancellor. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, as you know, when these foundations are created, they are somewhat independent. A group of women and men in that area work on the foundation, and the reason it's permitted to exist is to be generally supportive to the college or university. A lot of the work so far has tended to be scholarships, and we're not directive about that. But there's so many needs that there's so much to do that we never have had the intention at this point, although we may need to, that it's necessarily in capital. We've looked to this organization is owned by the people of Minnesota, and we've looked to the legislature and the governor to be the primary supporters of the capital projects. And you know already that on many of these projects, our students do pay for a third of the cost through tuition. And you know how that works. But these foundations have quite a bit of autonomy on how they decide to care to help the college. But we do want it to be helping them with their plans. We don't want it to be spending it for something that is not important to the president.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Seeing no other questions, I think... Oh, wait a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking here as you were talking, and I looked at this one slide, slide number 12 that you had on the, and that reflected the HEPR that you got last time, or last year. What was the amount?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, the amount last time was $40 million, $41 million.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What you commented, you had said that you have like 60% of it or 70% of it committed now, and the other 30%,
70
that's going to be happening this year. And in those comments, you said something about doing all of it logistically wouldn't work as well because it was going to be putting more. But I mean, technically speaking, let's say we'd give you $40 or $50 million in HEPR this year, then we would be looking at a much faster rate of HEPR projects happening. And I guess, is that feasible to manage that, make that happen? Or your comments were that what didn't work for the $40 million we gave you last time,
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, this is working exceptionally well. This is a 2-year program that we sign up to. and we phased part of that HEPA program in year one and the remainder in year two. And what I was getting at is in the case of the roofing program, we put out part of that roofing program out to bid in year one. It's already designed, so when you appropriate the money, it's ready to go. We're designing year two, so when year two comes, which is just about now, we'll be putting out roof replacement projects for this construction season. Now, to the question, if this was $80 million, would we have an extended period? Not at all, because each campus is executing these projects. We're not doing this in St. Paul. That money goes to the campuses. They know how to get it under design, and they execute the money. And the commitment is universal around the system. And if you get that money, you have 2 years in which to put it under contract, and you have 30 months in which to spend all the money. And in the last, since 2000, 2002, 2005, and 2005, we have met and we are meeting that commitment.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for staff, just to confirm. Prevailing wage statutes apply to construction of these facilities?
Yes.
And the second question is, I'm wondering if the testifiers probably don't have an answer on this, but seeing as how we're within, with the governor's latest recommendations, we're within $60 million of the debt ceiling, would the testifiers have any, what? Go ahead.
Go ahead and ask that question again.
Did I say something wrong? What was?
How many, within how far the debt ceiling?
I thought we were within $60 million of the $990 million. With the debt added on, we're not?
Governor, is the GEO funding at 845 GEO?
Oh, I'm using the overall number. Okay. Well, given the fact that we're close to the overall 3%, and just because I like to make lobbyists scurry for their cell phones, I'm wondering if the testifiers would have an opinion if perhaps the 3% ceiling on debt service, there was some sort of modification to that in exchange for a modification in prevailing wage statutes to allow for more efficient use of dollars and allow more resources to be on the table. If the testifiers have any opinions on either one of those possible reforms.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a bit above my pay grade, as we would say. The statute, the prevailing wage, of course, as you know, is founded in statute, and that's what we abide by.
Mr. Chair, I think we have to say that we would abide by that current statute at the present time, and we would, though, hope that after your very serious consideration of these needs, that it might be possible to make increased investments in the Minnesota State College and Universities. We have a third of the buildings in the state of Minnesota, so if you look at that overall budget, I think this request is very much in line with what we need, and I hope some additional funds can be invested.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, sometimes I like to think out loud. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't.
All right. Well, that's good. thank you. Is there any other questions that we can? All right, good. There is one. Representative Dorn.
Mr. Chair, and to the witness, I'm just wondering if any foundation has ever raised private dollars for a HEPA project.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Representative Dorn, not to the best of my knowledge.
And Mr. Chair, the follow-up thought would be, I wonder if anybody's ever been asked, and I realize there's not a lot of glory in having your name attached to, you know, a roof membrane or whatever, but it seriously might be some alumni who, if asked, might they could respond positively to that in terms of their feeling for what was there when they were there. And I just wondered if they had ever been asked or if it had ever happened. And I don't need the answer now, Mr. Chair.
Give me an H.
You have
give me an E.
Mr. Chair.
The Heaper Chair.
President Davenport tells me he has done that.
Oh, okay. Well, look at that. He's an innovator, that guy.
Outside of the box.
Outside of the box.
Yes.
Okay, with that, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time. If we have other questions, we'll get them to you, but appreciate all the information that you provide the committee. It makes our
you,
job
Chairman,
easier.
Thank you,
Member of the Committee. Thank you very much. With that, the next group will be our friends at the University of Minnesota. We're going to ask President Brunix to speak first because he's got to get out of Dodge here at soon. Going to, Rice and Roni Convention in San Francisco or something. I don't know what it's all about. But.
I think we finally got the seats assigned here.
There you go.
So we're ready to roll.
Thank you, President Brunix, coming down today. Would you please identify yourself for the tape and then begin your presentation?
So I'm Bob Brunix, President of the University of Minnesota, and it's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. I'm going to take a few moments. I'm going to try to make this very quick so we have some chance for questions and comments. I'll just give a quick preview of the university's biannual capital request. And as I start my comments, I'd like to acknowledge that there are three members of the university's Board of Regents with us here this afternoon. Regent Stephen Hunter, Regent David Metzen, past chair of the university's Board of Regents, and Regent Patty Simmons, who serves as vice chair of the board at the present time.
Chairman in charge of vice? Is that what I heard you say?
Pardon?
He's in charge of vice?
She's a vice chair.
Oh, vice chair. I'm sorry, Doctor.
They have no vice at the University of Minnesota.
I had that
with no approved forms that I know of. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be with you. I'd like to begin with an expression of my appreciation for your support of the University of Minnesota in the 2005 legislative session. It was a real shot in the arm to have a state appropriation for the University of Minnesota after we all lived through a very tough session and a recession in the state of Minnesota. Tuition was held to single digits for 2 years in a row. We'll be, when we make our budget up in June, we were able to invest in very significant academic priorities in research, support of students, in the university's public mission, and of course we put the bonding bill to very good use and started to modernize classrooms and conduct the rest of the capital projects that you approved in 2005. I spoke last week about the university's status in the state, its progress, its productivity, and the State of the University address, and I can tell you that I think we're making very good progress. I think the university is strong. This year we saw an increase again in student applications, about 3,000 this year, 30% increase in applications on the Twin Cities campus alone. And faculty and staff were awarded over $560 million in competitive research and contract funds. I'd like to spend a little time talking about the 2006 request. On the screen before you are the objectives that serve as the foundation of this request. In 2006, we are putting a lot of emphasis, a great deal of emphasis, on serving the needs of our students. We want to make the kinds of investments that are necessary so that students can pursue the careers of their interest and receive the kind of academic support and support through our facilities that their education requires. There is at least one project in this list, or actually several, that support research, not just on the Twin Cities campus, but around the state of Minnesota. And there are projects in this request that support the university's public mission through its research and outreach centers located in different parts of Minnesota. We have also tried in this request not only to take care of the capital assets and improve them at the University of Minnesota, but through a very careful planning process, we've worked very hard to leverage these investments to solve other problems at the same time in the location of buildings or the location of other things that we're trying to improve. And I'll give you several examples as I go through my presentation very briefly of how that is playing out on the campuses of the University of Minnesota. We start with PIPA. You had some discussion of PIPA just a moment ago with my colleagues from Minsky. These are the projects that are really essential to take care of what we have on all of our campuses. The projects on our list were very sizable. We had 150 projects in the $80 million request that we made as a part of our capital proposal. And those projects are statewide in nature, cover the Twin Cities, Crookston, Duluth, and Morris campuses, and all the and really all the regional centers and field stations of the university throughout the state. I don't need to go into the reasons why we have HEPA. I think the committee is very familiar. This is a critically important investment to preserve the buildings we have, deal with serious deficiencies, make sure our buildings are up to code, and make sure those buildings are safe. By July 2006, it's our judgment that 90% of our HEPA and major project dollars approved in 2005 will be under contract or under construction from that appropriation. Let me take just a few moments to talk about the specific building projects. The first project is the Twin Cities project for the Carlson School of Management. This is a building located on the west bank of the University of Minnesota. It will allow the University of Minnesota's Twin Cities campus to nearly double the undergraduate enrollment in the Carlson School of Management and allow us to relocate the Department of Economics into this new structure. It comes to us, it is supported by a $10 million donation and gift from Herb and Bar Hansen. Herb Hansen was a graduate in the Department of Economics in the late 1940s. The Carlson School enjoys an enviable reputation nationwide and around the world for the quality of its educational programs. The undergraduate program is ranked about 7th nationally. The MBA programs are clearly in the top 15. At the present time, we admit 1 out of 8 freshmen who apply to this program. The students have awesome qualifications. About 77% of the applicants are from the state of Minnesota. And a very surprising finding from some of our research is that 42% roughly of the students we do not admit travel outside the state of Minnesota and secure their education in other states. I happen to think that's too high a number for our state and for the University of Minnesota. This project also solves some very significant and growing problems on the west bank of the University of Minnesota. It allows us to solve some very severe overcrowding, to do so in a way that will save about $18 million of remodeling costs through the relocation of the Department of Economics. The second building on our list, priority, is at the University of Minnesota Duluth. It's the Leibovitz School of Business and Economics. This is a 20-plus-year-old building that's largely obsolete and too small to accommodate the class of about 2,000 students that we serve in this major at the undergraduate and at the MBA level. This building, too, is benefited by a nearly $5 million gift from Joel and Cheryl Leibovitz. The vacated space in the existing building will allow us to take care of some critical space needs on the UMD campus and solve some of the space deficiency problems we have. As with the other projects, this one will allow us to address some very serious upgrades to the campus utility infrastructure. And these are necessary to support this building and others on the Duluth campus. The enrollment in business and economics has grown 65% in just a few years at UMD. The UMD Leibovitz School is one of 4 accredited business schools in the state of Minnesota, one of 425 in the nation. And it's very strongly connected to the regional economy in northern Minnesota. The third project priority is called the Science Teaching and Student Services Building or Center. This building is located on the Mississippi River. on the Washington Avenue, right adjacent to the Washington Avenue Bridge and the Wiseman Art Museum. I think it's one of the ugliest buildings in the entire world. I said in the Western Hemisphere this morning that I'm getting more expansive as the day goes on. The building was never finished. It is actually looks and feels worse when you go inside than it does when you look at it from the outside. It's very costly to maintain. The utility costs are roughly 25% more for the usable square feet in that space than we have in other buildings on the Twin Cities campus. We would demolish this building, build a new science classroom and student services building in this location, and we think this is an ideal solution and an important need for the university for a number of reasons. First of all, it's an ideal location. About half of the students on the Twin Cities campus walk by this particular area on a daily basis. It's a building that is located very close to chemistry, physics, and the engineering sciences on the Twin Cities campus. It's a building that provides will provide services through its science classrooms. These are large demonstration classrooms that support about 50 majors on the Twin Cities campus. And it will also be the center for consolidating those direct services that we provide to students in advisement, career services, financial services, international programs, and many other areas. The next project is Biomedical Sciences Building, again on the Twin Cities campus. This building would be located near the McGuire Building in the Magnetic Resonance Research Building on the Twin Cities campus. It would also allow the University of Minnesota to seriously upgrade the utility infrastructure and clean up an environmental problem on that part of the campus. We think this is an important investment for the state of Minnesota and a critical investment to make in our future. This building would include what we call a BSL, or a Biosafety Lab 3, or Level 3 laboratory, to conduct very sensitive research on infectious diseases. It would support the kind of work that is represented in a proposal we're submitting to the Center for Disease Control this month, a $35 million application for 5 years of funding. Its primary focus would be not only on infectious diseases, but also supporting critically important work in cancer, immunology, and pharmacology. This space would solve some other problems on the Twin Cities campus. It would allow us to relocate some scientists in their laboratories from Hosmer Hall next to the Kauffman Memorial Union, move into this site, and allow the university, enable the university to establish a new and badly needed biomedical engineering and medical devices center to support the thriving industries that we have in the state of Minnesota. These are really important areas of research to support. They strengthen the university's already considerable position in the biomedical sciences. It helps us ensure that the university stays connected to some of the most important needs that we face in Minnesota, particularly in relationship to the biomedical sector of the state's economy. We have put forward what I think is a very creative proposal to address the long-range and long-term needs of the state to invest in biomedical sciences, particularly in the biomedical sciences infrastructure of the University of Minnesota. I'd be pleased to talk about this proposal and idea in the time we have available for questions and comments. Finally, I mentioned that this request includes investment in research and field stations throughout the state of Minnesota. We have identified three for this particular capital request. First of all, a building to accommodate faculty and student housing at the Cedar Creek Natural History Center. It'd be a dormitory-style housing unit that would allow our researchers to live on the campus and conduct their research mostly during the spring, summer, and fall. This is one of the most cited, most highly recognized centers related to ecology, our environment, biodiversity, all the things that are really important when it comes to renewable energy and our environment. The second project is at Cloquet at the Forestry Center. It would make a number of improvements to the administration building. It is also a place where we house one of the university's regional extension center offices. The final project is at Morris at the West Central Research and Outreach Center. And this too would expand office space and research space, educational space at the Outreach Center. This happens to be the Center for Applied Research in Renewable Energy. It's an area where we have focused a lot of our research in wind energy, biomass, and biofuels. It's becoming well-known not only in Minnesota as a center for innovation and research, but also around the country. Just in conclusion, I think this is a sound capital budget. It presents some very important priorities for the long-term future of the University of Minnesota. It clearly builds upon the university's unique strengths, roles, and responsibility in Minnesota's system of higher education, placing a strong emphasis upon supporting our students and the research mission of the University of Minnesota. I would also like to argue that we've constructed this capital plan not just to advance these priorities, but also to solve at the same problem critical issues in Duluth and on the Twin Cities campus. And I think this proposal of funding will greatly strengthen the university's ability to serve our state. So I'd be happy to take your comments and questions at this time about this proposal or any other issue that you wish to raise.
Thank you, President Brunix. Representative Plowski. Mr. Chair, President Brunix, I notice on your list that the buildings that are rated above the medical bioscience building, at least a couple of them had sizable private donations. So I'm going to go on the same list of or tone of questions I had with Minsky. Does it make a difference with the University of Minnesota if you have a sizable private commitment in the ranking of these buildings?
President Brunix.
Representative Kowalski, it doesn't make a difference as to whether a project gets on a list, to be honest with you. For example, the 2005 list did not have any private contributions. The university funded nearly $90 million in the last 7 years with state support for the College of Liberal Arts, and hardly any of those buildings have private gifts. In setting the priorities, we will look at a private gift to see if it should accelerate a project, but a project doesn't get on the list for any kind of priority consideration simply because a private gift is available.
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair, President Brunix, thank you. Then my next question would be, in the private gifts of the buildings that you have up there, is there a timeline on when that money is available?
President Brunix.
Yes. Representative McNamara, Representative Plowski, the answer would be yes. I spend a lot of my time trying to raise private money on behalf of the University of Minnesota. It's rare that you will get a capital gift that doesn't have a short timeline, or at least a reasonably short timeline. People will often make gifts to the academic mission of the university, to student scholarships on a permanent long-term basis. They will make them also for endowing professorships and chairs. But it's rare that they'll make a capital gift unless they see the possibility of that gift being realized in a reasonable period of time.
Representative Paul. Mr. Chair, President Brunix, I'm going to then ask the next question. Does the timeline make a difference in whether or not that building is going to be ranked?
President Brunix.
Yes. Representative McNamara, Representative Plowski, the answer is yes. And I think that's a relatively good thing. I wouldn't put a priority on the list, to be honest with you, as the president of the university, if I didn't believe it was in the best interest of the university or something that we would need to do in a relatively short period of time. But it's entirely possible that I might recommend to the Board of Regents that we move up a project 2 years in the cycle if we could take advantage of some very significant private funding.
Representative Plowski.
President Brunix, I hope there are still Minsky people in the room that are listening to this. I've got another question. How many classrooms are in the science buildings that we see up there? Can you give me some idea of what we're looking at for classrooms?
President Brunick.
Yes. Representative McNamara, Representative Flaherty. These are large demonstration classrooms, and I believe there are six large demonstration classrooms in chemistry and physics in this building. And they have high technological capability so that you can teach chemistry and physics in the way that I think they're intended to be taught in the modern times.
So, Mr. Chair, and President Bruce, just one last question. I had heard that one of these buildings might end up in Rochester. Could you tell me which one? And
which one? Representative McNamara, Representative Pulaski, I haven't yet negotiated the transfer of any assets, physical assets, to Rochester.
So, Mr. Chair, President Brunix, none of these buildings are targeted for Rochester. Is that correct?
President Brunix.
That is correct.
Okay. Other questions for the university? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Medical biosciences building that's on your current agenda, were this other concept to be funded, would that be in a sense part of that package and it would be the first building of that? Or?
President Brunix.
Chair McNamara, Representative Hausman, it could very easily be the case that the biomedical sciences building would move to the new authority if it was passed and authorized by the legislature and signed by the governor. So that is a distinct possibility. But absent the presence of an authority, we felt we needed to make it a priority in our capital request.
President Brooks, you know, when I read the governor's summary at his bonding proposal, one thing that jumped out at me was a comparison of square feet between the university and Minskew. And I was surprised how close they are. And I'm just curious if you have any comments on why that would be. I guess they have so many more students. I'm just curious what are the space requirements at the university that causes those to be so similar.
Chair Darman, members of the committee, I'm not sure I can answer this in any specific way, but I think part of the answer would be related to the mission of the University of Minnesota. The instruction we provide with 40% of our students on the Twin Cities campus, for example, in graduate and professional programs is much more laboratory intensive, the kinds of degree programs we have in Duluth and the Twin Cities would require much more intensive space. The other thing I would argue is that the university, with its research and land grant responsibility, has a number of offices and research centers throughout Minnesota. They're vitally important to our state. They allow the university to strongly connect the benefits of our research and educational programs to the needs of local communities throughout Minnesota. So I think part of it relates to the difference in our mission, I think, the difference in how we carry out our mission. We would have many fewer part-time students who would access programs, sort of in the evening, but many more of our students would be studying with us full time. But I think the difference would be largely related to the research and the outreach mission of the University of Minnesota. And I think one of the things that is really important in evaluating enrollment data is to also look at some other really important statistics, and that is, the conversion to full-year equivalent students, the degree graduates, what fields they graduate in. I think Minnesota is well served by having the public and private systems that we have in our state at the present time.
Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Brunix, I'm curious about the Carlson School expansion, if that building is designed already or what phase you are in.
Well, Chair Darman, Representative Kelleher, we're well along the road. The design work is done for the Carlson building. If approved, we would go immediately into construction, at least by fall.
And Mr. Chair, President Brunix, I'm sorry that I wasn't on the tour, and maybe I need to get a little more detail of this. I mean, one of the concerning things about the present, interface between the Humphrey Institute and the Carlson School, although I know that the current interim dean, Jim Campbell's doing really good work in trying to get sectors to talk to one another in terms of graduate school. I do think that there's some opportunity there for better integrated design, and maybe you can have your folks show that to me, because right now it feels pretty prison-like on the outside. In the inside, it's a fabulous building. It's a really wonderful,
it's very functional,
wonderful facility. But I guess the integration of how that is on the campus and how it feels on the campus could go a long way to maybe help bridge those sorts of interactions. So,
okay. Representative Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. President, I don't think you specified in your opening remarks, but did you say what happens to those 7 out of 8 Carlson School applicants who are not admitted to the Carlson School? Do you know where they go?
Governor Brunix.
Chair Darman, Representative Latz, nearly 50% of them leave Minnesota and go to other colleges and universities. The remaining 50% go to other public and private institutions in Minnesota. A very high number would go to private institutions in Minnesota, or a high proportion.
Representative Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, with regard to your HEPA request, the governor recommended funding 50% of your request, $40 million out of the $80 million request. If you were to be given an additional $40 million, would you use that to fill out the rest of HEPA, or would you apply it to other buildings? And if so, how would you prioritize that?
Chair Darman, Representative Latz, I'm assuming the question is, if the capital bill was $80 million, how would we spend $80 million? Is that another way to phrase it?
Not completely.
I'm hoping you'll do much better than that, obviously.
Well, I didn't quite ask it that way. Would you answer that first and then answer
well, I would say,
what the governor's recommending?
Yeah, I would answer the question this way. We obviously think the $80 million we put in the HEPA request is well-founded, it's urgently needed. But if the capital bonding allocation, appropriation, is less than what we've asked for by some significant amount, as it is in the governor's bill, I would prefer that we stay with $40 million in HEPA and fund as many of the projects as possible. For example, I want the Research and Outreach Center project funding restored. I'd like to see either through the Biomedical Science Facility Authority or through the bonding bill to get the full funding for the Biomedical Sciences building. So to me, it's a trade-off. It's very, very difficult to make this call, but that outcome would serve the university's interests better. It would allow us to leverage the full resources of the University of Minnesota, and I think put us in a position to keep our academic programs strong for the future. So I think we gain more by ensuring that we have a balance between HEPA and the project priorities that we have on this list.
Representative Latz.
Just to clarify then, given the order in which you have prioritized the building requests, you would continue to keep those in the same order. And if you had an additional $40 million, you would apply those, starting with dollar one, to the outreach buildings, and then after that, to the biomedical science building.
Chair Norman, Representative Latz, if I need to come back to your question, I think I could easily last $40 million here, which isn't my habit. But anyway, I'm assuming that the question is, if you would add $40 million to the governor's, what would we do? That's a much better question. I definitely would fund the research and outreach centers and the biomedical sciences building as the priority.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Latz.
Just to follow up, and sorry I missed part of Minsky's presentation, although I heard it in higher ed finance, and I don't know if they commented on this or not, but in higher ed finance they did comment when I asked the question about HEPA priorities, versus the other building requests. The chancellor responded in that committee that if they were funded $110 million, that their priority would be put all of it into HEPR, because for their priorities at this time, 100% of their HEPR requests is higher priority than any of the buildings in Minsku. And that's not to say that the buildings aren't important. I think we ought to go as far down that list as we can as well. But just, I don't know if they commented on that before I came into the room, but I thought it important information for this committee to hear as well.
Mr. Chairman, could I just add?
Oh, feel free.
10 seconds or so. It's very difficult sometimes with respect to these projects to separate HEPR from non-HEPR. Give you an example. The science teaching and student services building, if you take that, if you demolish that building, that is a huge HEPR problem and a high-cost HEPR problem to fix. And so sometimes you use projects to solve HEPR problems at the same time. My reason for answering your question this way is to indicate that if funded at less than the full amount, I would want to reach as far and get as much done as possible with private funding, internal university resources, and the support of the state.
Senator Bruce, just so I understand your answer to Representative Lass's question, when you start, if you use the governor's recommendations as a template and you start to add dollars to that, did I understand you to say you would add dollars first to the regional centers?
It depends on, Chair Darman, it depends on how much. We were talking, yes, if we're talking about a small increment, I think that has to be the first priority. If we're talking about a more substantial increase over the governor's recommendation, I would try to reach as far as possible to cover both of those needs of the University of Minnesota. But, you know, the state obligation, or the state request for research and outreach centers is about $2.8 million. These are really important projects that benefit greater Minnesota and the work that we do there, and I'd want to cover those first. But I'd want to reach as far as possible. With the biomedical sciences building, if that building gets built, we put the scientists in that building will generate a $20 million a year funding stream to support the research of the University of Minnesota, and it's critically important to moving us to the next level in biomedical research.
But you're not necessarily changing your ranking of those projects.
Well, I think one has to be flexible in this world. If the amount of money is $40 million, then I would try to reach as much as possible to both of those priorities. If it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 5, I don't think, I think you'd have to approach it in a different way. But I look forward to working with the committee on that kind of a problem.
I know your time is limited, but in various forms, we've talked and others have talked, and I hear it come up, help us understand your overall ranking, because a lot of members in this committee look at the bioscience building as kind of an end run, not necessarily by you, but around the 3% limit, and the Gopher Stadium looks and walks and talks a lot like a bonding request, and so as we start to put our bill together, help us understand the university's requests. Where do you put the bioscience buildings into that? Where do you put the stadium into that? At the end of the day, they're all dollars.
Chair Darman, I was truly hoping we would not be sitting here talking about a stadium in the 2006 legislative session. I believe quite strongly that we have to solve this problem for the future of the university and our state. We proposed, I think, a very creative way to do so, funding 60% of it with non-state resources raised by the University of Minnesota. And it's my fervent hope that we do not mix it up with the academic priorities of the University of Minnesota. In fact, you will find on the website of the University of Minnesota a principle adopted by the university's Board of Regents that indicates that we do not want to trade off our long-term academic interests to bring Gopher football back to the campus. But I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's the right time to do it. If we don't do it now, we're going to lose probably pretty close to $100 million of private support. And we'll be facing this issue 4 to 5 years from now with a $500 million price tag and no private support to help us out. So those are some of the dilemmas that you just have to juggle in a position like mine. I can tell you that the most unpopular thing I can imagine is to advocate for bringing the football stadium back to campus during the $185 million budget cut. Secondly, the biomedical sciences are a very important long-term priority. This particular building is ranked third in line fourth in line this year for some very important reasons, and that is we just have to take care of some of the urgent student needs that we have in Duluth and on the Twin Cities campus. If we don't get traction on this particular building this year, it will be the top priority in 2008. I can assure you of that because the need is very, very urgent. I don't regard the biomedical sciences facilities authority proposal as anything close to an end run around the capital process, but I do think it's important to recognize that the University of Minnesota has some very unique responsibilities in the state of Minnesota. In the biomedical area, we are the state's primary research engine, the primary means by which we undertake the major discoveries in human health that are so important to not only our citizens in Minnesota, but people around the world. And I view this very much as a long-term state infrastructure investment. If we go ahead and try to position the state of Minnesota in a highly competitive way going forward, we will have to build one of these buildings every about 2 years at around $75 million. That would be a very big chunk of the university's capital bonding bill, probably 60-70% by normal standards, leaving about 35% for HEPA and all the other academic responsibilities in the University of Minnesota on every campus of our system and across the state of Minnesota in our research stations. I don't think that's sustainable. So I do think the state is at a critical juncture. Are we going to make an investment, maintain the strength of the University of Minnesota, which I think is one of the better places in the country and in the world, maintain the foundational work that we need to support the thriving biomedical sciences industries in Minnesota. There are over 500 such companies in Minnesota today. It's a big part of Minnesota's economy and quality of life. So I prefer not to have to put these difficult decisions on the table, but I do think from time to time people like me are called on to speak out and look down the road, think 5, 10, 15 years from now about what this state needs to look like. I do not want to be in a position of looking back and saying we had a great opportunity. We needed to do some modest investing in the long term to strengthen our state, and we took a pass. I don't want that chapter to be written on our watch, and I'm hoping what we hope will happen here is we'll get a strong public hearing for these ideas, that we'll have a rich public debate on the future of our state and the role of the University of Minnesota in supporting our aspirations.
Representative Hausman, on this point, or otherwise, Representative Eastland was next.
No.
Representative Eastland. Representative Hausman.
On the issue of the bioscience research buildings, because of the district I represent, I'm always in conversation with people from that campus. And Saturday night, I happened to be at a dinner table with both researchers from the university, research scientists, and then Anton Friem. And both agreed that, I mean, and they are only going by what they read in the newspaper, that they were surprised that there was emphasis being put on new buildings as a way of emphasizing bioscience research, because both said scientists don't care at all about space. And the one from the university said, I don't come here because of buildings, I come here because of people. And, you know, that's always been my concern about where we put our money and do we still have money left over for the people who are ultimately the reason why good scientists would come. So and both commented about that confusion about why we're putting emphasis on, like, what they, as they said, shiny new buildings.
Yes.
President Brunix.
Chair Darman, Representative Hausman, I think you've made a very powerful point. The first observation I would make is that the scientists from the university that you had dinner with are obviously in very good space. because I can tell you, we...
Here's what they actually said.
Yeah.
They actually said, the 3M guy said, I mean, we went to this one scientist and wanted to redecorate his office, and he said, get away from here.
Scientists don't care about what their offices look like. They care deeply about what their labs can do. Second point I would make is that the biomedical sciences strategy for the university can't be just a capital strategy, and I think you make that point very powerfully. So the long-range plan we have in this area and the financial performance to support it would put the operating costs on the university's ledger, be our responsibility. And much of the responsibility for making the investment in people, that is, in the scientists, in the graduate students, and professional students who study and work with them, would be the responsibility of the University of Minnesota. I would also add much of the scientific equipment would be very much on our watch as well. So what we're proposing is a 10-year strategy that's much more comprehensive than just bricks and mortar. And I think our observation is directly to the directly on the mark, and it's clearly one that we're thinking about and we're working to develop. At the present time, for example, there's a $250 million initiative that we are supporting to raise private capital as well as internal university resources to support the medical school over the next 5 to 10 years, and that would be very much part of this initiative as well. We need to rebuild and strengthen the medical school of the University of Minnesota. It must be a top priority.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And unlike Representative Hausman's dinner guests last Saturday night, mine were asking about the university also, but it was about the football stadium. So we evidently went out to dinner with a completely different group. because unlike what you've mentioned, President Brunick, that you'd like us to separate the university's capital requests from the stadium requests, which I very much support, the people talk about it all the time. Do you think that we can reach out a little bit more and be a little bit more creative and find a way that there's something that maybe it will benefit the university and the state to make the $92 million a little more acceptable to us legislators? And I don't have anything in particular, but I'm just wondering, I understand. I mean, I absolutely, the Carlson School, which happens to be Representative Demmer and mine alma mater, and we went at a time, 20 in his case and 30 years in my case, when you weren't in the top 5%. We don't fit in that. Maybe Representative Demmer does, but I certainly don't. It was easier to get in. Those are important, absolutely, and we support them. But the football stadium, people are asking about it, and I guess just I want to hear from you. What is there something we can be doing? Is there additional ways we got to think of making this happen? And I'm not taking away from this. Absolutely, you give a compelling argument of why we should spend $269.1 million. That being said, there's an argument out there about $92 million for a football on-campus stadium.
Yeah.
Governor Brunick.
Chair Darman, Representative McNamara, let me say a couple of things. When we debated about when the Vikings walked out of the discussion we had, and I think they made the right call for the Vikings. It was the wrong business model for the Minnesota Vikings to try to site and locate a campus on our stadium on the university campus. And quite frankly, you can't operate a pro stadium on a university campus. The thing would have been larger than the entire mall of the Twin Cities campus, would have been going 24/7 when we have another mission to serve the public. So I think it was the right thing for them, and I think it was the right thing for the University of Minnesota. But anyway, when that happened, we had to come up with a plan that we thought would maintain the football program at the University of Minnesota and accomplish other things at the same time. I think the plan we have on the table, which forces us to go out and really raise private money and solve $150 million of a $250 million challenge, is a pretty courageous act on the part of the University of Minnesota. And we carefully constructed this to ensure that we could protect the academic interests and mission of the University of Minnesota. I think if the dollar amount gets much larger than this and the obligation gets any larger for the University of Minnesota, I'm not sure we can pull this off. I think it's going to be a challenge enough to get to $150 million. So we constructed this to maintain the state's liability as low as possible. And what worries me about some other proposals to raise the ante for the state is I worry about its trade-off against these academic interests. Because there is, you make a good point and a powerful point, there is only so much money to go around and to fund all the vitally important issues that our state needs to address. But we have played football at the Division I level for 124 years. I suspect we'll play for another 100 years. I probably won't see that last game. But anyway, we're going to play them for a while. And I would also say we've done one other thing that I think is helpful in selling this idea or presenting this idea to the general public. And that is, we have made this more than a football stadium. It's a home for the University of Minnesota marching band. It will be a place for intramural programs. Our marching band has no home at the present time. You'll see where these kids operate out of. And I think it's a great state treasure. It'll be a place where we'll hold career fairs. We can hold graduations, concerts. It will be a place like the Ohio State University that holds probably 130 to 150 events a year. So we want it to be a center of our academic community, a place where Minnesota can gather. I'd like to see the same kind of venues we have at places like Penn State and Ohio State, where game day is also a day to celebrate the academic mission of the University of Minnesota and an opportunity to share our laboratories and our learning experiences with young kids and families throughout Minnesota. So I think we're trying very, very hard to present it as more than a football investment, but we have to be clear, one of its primary purposes is obviously to support the football program and the athletics program of the University of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. We'll get you on the list there. And Representative Brunix, tell me, what time do you have to leave? 10 minutes ago?
I was just told that somebody's pulled up and the meter's running, but I can take one more question.
Okay, so we got
I love
John
it.
Last and Carter,
yeah.
And we'll get to those, but I guess what I haven't heard you say, and it goes back to the original question of priorities, and I struggle with it. I sent one telegram in my entire life. The telegram was the Board of Regents saying, don't tear down Memorial Stadium. Don't do it. Don't do it because you didn't need to do it yet. I believe you ought to play football on campus. So I'm with you. But I struggle with listening to the needs of the bioscience building, and in my head, $7 million a year gets you $100 million of bonding. Help me understand that, because I struggle with that, and I want to see you play football on campus, but I just have a hard time trying to hear what your priorities are there, and help me understand that. But then we'll go to Representative Kahn, too. So I don't know how you want to answer that.
Chair Darman, obviously the highest priorities of the University of Minnesota are going to be academic priorities, but I would urge the state not to make this a choice between our academic and non-academic priorities. You are going to have to solve this problem, and I would argue the time to solve this problem is now, when we can afford it, when we can access a lot of private capital to help us get it done. I know these are difficult decisions and difficult trade-offs. If we can't get the stadium, all I'd like is an up or down vote. If it's not something the state is willing to support, we've been out there 3.5 years. We've done our part. We put our plan out there. It's had a lot of support in legislative committees and with the general public. So I would just like to have an up or down vote on it. And if the answer is no, we'll move on and do something else. But sooner or later, we're going to have to pay the piper on this one. We're going to have to come up with a solution.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Chairman, the University of Minnesota is also one institution that also has its own bonding capacity. How is that being used, and how does that fit into the picture of these requests?
Chair Darman, I actually can answer this question at about a 65 to 70% level, but I'm going to introduce Mr. Fitzenreiter, who can knock it out of the ballpark. And then I have to to run for an airplane. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to deal with you this afternoon.
Thank you, President Burns. I will ask a couple questions, however.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, I'm Richard Fitzenreiter, the CFO and treasurer at the University of Minnesota. And every fall, we take to the Board of Regents a six-year capital plan. And each fall that we bring that six-year capital plan, we do a debt capacity forecast. That forecast is reviewed with the Board of Regents. And frankly, it's not dissimilar from how the state approaches its debt capacity, but we use three different financial ratios instead of one, and we blend those together and do a forecast of our debt. Today, the university has approximately $667 million worth of debt outstanding. The interest rate on that debt is about 4.48%, and the average life of that debt is about 11.2 years. We structure our debt to get low cost and pay it off as rapidly as we can in order to recycle that debt capacity. We've done a debt capacity forecast for the next 6 years. That forecast drove us to a capacity of $596 million. In that $596 million, included in that is our six-year plan for state requests, our share of the one-third. It includes the stadium debt that we would issue, roughly $184 million. It also includes an amount that we reserve for emergencies. And also we have several large projects on the horizon, including parking ramps, housing facilities, and et cetera, that the university bonds for and pays with its own funds. But we do have a debt capacity forecast, and we do plan around that forecast.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, do we ever see that in our discussion? Do we see that in, for example, I guess what I didn't hear is what's open, how much more debt could you take on this year, and what is it planned for?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as I mentioned, we did a forecast for the next 6 years. That capacity was $596 million. We built a capital plan, a six-year capital plan, using that debt capacity entirely.
Do we see that capital plan?
That capital plan is published when we take it to the board. I would be happy to bring that presentation. In fact, I gave a copy of that presentation to John Walls, the fiscal analyst, to look at. I'd be happy to come by and share it with anyone to show you what we're doing. But I've never been asked, Mr. Chairman, to make a formal presentation here about it, or in any committee here.
So I guess the obvious next question is, why wouldn't you put some or part of all of these requests into that capital plan?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the one-third share of the capital projects is in that debt capacity. Other projects the university finances is in that debt capacity. The football stadium, $184 million of it, is in that capacity. So, like I said, I'd be happy to come by and share with you exactly how that $596 million is allotted.
And sorry, this may be just beating something that everyone else understands. But if we fund less than what you're asking us to fund, then that frees up a lot of one-third.
Mr. Chairman, members, that's correct. And next fall we'll do a six-year plan that adds another year to the six-year plan that isn't there today. We update it annually, and that debt capacity will be allotted for the next one-third out there in the 2012 request. And I won't, Mr. Chairman, I won't know what you funded or didn't fund until you're done.
Okay. And then how much of the debt capacity is still tied up in the steam plant?
Mr. Chairman, members, in the $667 million that we have outstanding today, which isn't about debt capacity, it's about what outstanding. A portion of that is paying off. No. I'm talking about new debt capacity over what we have outstanding today. Inside what we have outstanding, there is debt being retired on the steam plant. I don't today offhand know how much that is. It's still a sizable number.
Representative Lass.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment relating to the stadium, and I guess in response to Representative McNamara's question, he's not here to hear my response, for whatever it's worth. As I understand the numbers, the university's coming forward presenting a stadium that will be 60% privately funded.
Only if you consider the students private donors. Okay.
Well, not out of official public dollars anyway. We've got a couple of privately owned businesses that are coming forward asking for public dollars for their stadiums and are funding theirs at quite a lot less contribution from the private side. University is a public institution. It is uniquely the state's responsibility, far more in a way than any other individual private business. And so I think we have to look at it through a different lens. And I guess a question and a follow-up on Mr. Fitzenreiter's response to Representative Kahn as well. As I understand it, then, the university's debt is the payment on that is coming out of the university's operating revenue, I assume. Is that correct? And if so, it's coming out of the state appropriations and out of tuition. Am I understanding that financing mechanism correctly?
Mr. Chairman, members, are you asking in terms of the stadium itself?
The other entire debt capacity. What you guys?
Of the debt we have outstanding, $667 million, roughly, and I'm talking about what we've already issued in outstanding, not anything new. About half of that debt is the result of parking ramps, housing facilities, remodeling of Kauffman that are really paid by users, not out of the general operating budget of the institution. It's about 50-50 right now. Mm-hmm. Our annual debt service payment is around $70 million.
Kelleher.
Why don't you pause there? You got to jump in.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking.
All right. We'll continue to think while Representative Kelleher answer a question.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, and this is, I raised my hand when the President was up there, but I think you can help me with both of these. First of all, you got my attention when you said you might be building more parking ramps. And I guess I will ask this formally on the record as a request. I'd like to know what the parking capacity at the university is right now and how that impacts with light rail and planned light rail coming through the campus in terms of making sure that we are not overextended on revenue bonds in regard to parking. So I'll just make that as a request, and it doesn't have to be answered right now unless you have a quick, pithy answer for that one. And then I'm very curious, actually, the President got my attention when he said that there would be concerts at the stadium, and I honestly, with Representative Murphy's prodding, sort of got thinking about this in terms of, you know, right now we are having a bit of a battle between the X and the Target Center in terms of concert bookings right now. So I'm just curious in the business plan, you know, where are we going with this? How many concerts per year? What does it look like? Who's going to be booking the concerts? Clear Channel, someone else, the university? All of a sudden I just got really, really intrigued. So what's the business plan look like for the concert side?
Mr. Chairman, members, I have my colleague here.
Vice President O'Brien, nice to see you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelleher, I'm, for the record, Kathleen O'Brien, Vice President for University Services at the University of Minnesota. Thank you. First, to respond to Vice President, to Representative Kelleher's question relating to parking. The University of Minnesota has about 18,000 parking spaces. About 15,000 of those are in facility, about 3,000 in surface parking places. I'm just speaking about the Twin Cities campus at this point. When Mr. Fitzenreiter was talking about debt service on parking facilities, he was talking about existing facilities. We have no current plans to build additional facilities. The University of Minnesota has about two-thirds of its daily trips to campus by something other than single occupancy vehicle. We are the largest employer using a MetroPass program. We have 17,000 students using a University Pass program, and we were recently recognized by the federal EPA and Department of Transportation as one of the best commuter in workplaces in the country. And so although that might belie individuals' experience with the University of Minnesota, actually we're very aggressively pursuing a transit-friendly environment.
Mr. Chair, I just asked the question because I thought I heard Mr. Fitzenreiter say in the planned use of debt capacity that there was more parking ramps planned. And I understood it to be that there wasn't, but I just want to clarify right now because I do think this is an important sort of larger question in the next 10 to 15 years of how this is all going to work in terms of LRT coming to campus, hopefully.
Chair Dorman and Representative Kelleher, I understood that and wanted to have an opportunity to tell our good story.
Right.
Now, in response to your second question with relationship to the stadium operations, the business plan for the football stadium does not envision the use of revenue from concerts. So it's not dependent on that for the operation of the stadium. We do believe that with a facility of that type, there will be an interest by our students who might be paying a student fee, by the university community to have some use of the facility, as the president suggested. As part of the environmental impact statement process, the Board of Regents completed the environmental impact review last week. We did investigate the use of the stadium for concerts. And in the EIS, the university has set parameters about events that would be comparable to the events we have today, comparable to the use of Williams Arena or Mariucci in that area, and events that would be using the larger facility. It's our estimate at this time that on an annual basis, including football games, there would be approximately a dozen events that would use the facility as a larger facility. We have made the commitment to have all of those events be within state noise standards and to really conduct the kind of mitigation testing prior to events and work with the community with the Standing Stadium Advisory Committee on the use of the facility and the use beyond the football games themselves.
Mr. Chair and
President Kelleher,
Vice President O'Brien, I guess I am curious about any contractual relationship with someone other than the university in terms of booking the concerts and whether we're going to go in direct competition with some of the other facilities. I mean, I understand the attraction of having concerts on the campus, and especially with that student fee issue going on, I'm sure that's a very attractive thing, but I am a little bit concerned about whether there's already an agreement, I don't know, with anyone else, whether you will be handling the university, meaning not necessarily you, but the university will be handling that. And we don't have to take this up completely today, but because it's getting long, but maybe we should have a longer conversation about that in terms of there just have been some stresses on the large concert venues and the revenues in terms of how that's all working. And maybe with a million more people in 10 years, that's not going to make a big difference, but it could.
Chair Dorman, Representative Kelleher, there's no such agreement at this time, and it hasn't been envisioned.
Okay.
President Last, did you want to jump
I'll
back?
I'll pass, Mr.
All right, sir. Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice President O'Brien, I have a question about something we heard on a different tour that you weren't part of, but I would like your response. When we went down the Central, or not, Metropolitan Transit Tour and report all those various modes of transportation and improvement. We followed the path of the Central Corridor, and we were told on our bus that it was okay to go through the various neighborhoods on land, above land, but when we got to the university, we were going to go tunnel under because the university was requesting that for, I got the impression, ambient reasons. And I was wondering if you'd done considerable discussion on that, or if that was set in your mind that we have to tunnel under the university roadways for this project, or is it still negotiable to go on land through the university neighborhood, just like we were going through all the neighborhoods where the houses were there?
Vice President, so
Chair Dorman, Representative Murphy. The draft environmental impact statement on the Central Corridor was developed by the Metro Council and Ramsey County staff that are leading the Central Corridor project. In, I believe, 1999 or 2000, and that draft EIS included a tunnel through the university campus. It is true that the university asked for consideration of a tunnel, and however, it was also the collective opinion when the draft EIS was written that that would be a prudent way to structure the Central Corridor, and it went into the federal government with that as a component. The concerns about the Central Corridor going through campus are essentially the functionality of the line. Right now, in order to ensure the speed of the line through campus and the number of riders required, about a quarter of the riders conservatively will be riders going to and from the university campus. Where the stops are and how the line is structured through the campus is very important to the functionality of the line. Second, there is a concern about safety on the line. Right now, our studies of pedestrian crossings on Washington Avenue through the campus are higher than pedestrians on grade in downtown Minneapolis, so we have a safety issue. This is also very close to the Academic Health Center, where we have every day hundreds of visitors coming to clinics at the university that aren't regularly on campus. Third, we're concerned about how an at-grade line would impact the taking of potential taking of private property, and we believe any development of the line throughout the Central Corridor should enhance economic development along the line. And fourth, we're concerned about the operation, functionality, and aesthetics of the campus. So there are a number of concerns. The Board of Regents, at the time the draft EIS was issued, took a position that as the Central Corridor was designed, if it was along a Washington Avenue alignment, that it would they would request consideration of it being below grade. It is because of the university's understanding of the cost of a below-grade element, we have gone out and conducted a study of what the impacts are on grade, and that study is what really gives me the information to respond to your question. We are part of the partnership that believes that the Central Corridor must be developed. We strongly support it, and we believe the kind of issues that I've outlined as concerns are issues that should be resolved during preliminary engineering, and that we really need to sit down as a partnership and determine how to have the most highly functional line. because the ridership and the timing of the line through the neighborhoods are what is going to result in the best operational line and the best revenue. And we believe that it's premature to arrive at a solution, but to really work with all of the partners to develop the best solution.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, friends, maybe. as you know, my neighborhood is very concerned about the stadium, has been, not my neighborhood, my community groups in my district, very concerned about this and have raised, I thought, some fairly reasonable requests that they feel they have just been blown off. And one of them is they're concerned about the fate of Firehouse Number 19, which we've talked about, and the concern about the university using eminent domain or the threat of eminent domain to take this building, which the owner has no intention, at least certainly at this time, of selling. It's also, and you know, they've heard threats that the university doesn't consider itself bound by any historic preservation considerations. Also, that I've asked to make sure that the university is covered by any eminent domain bills which are crossing our paths this session, which I've gotten kind of mixed answers on whether that's true or not. And they've also asked for something that I thought was really pretty reasonable, about a community impact mitigation fee. And I think one of the things that they suggested that be is, they understand the athletic games and they understand the need to support the athletic department, but some percentage of profits, which we obviously can't come because you don't have, it's not part of your business plan, but I assume there's going to be some profit from using it from other events, to be able to go into community mitigation. They're very concerned about the difference, for example, of the police support that's planned, and I haven't been involved in all these conversations, so, you know, please correct me if I'm saying something wrong, too. They're concerned about the level of police protection, police activity is a fraction of that the University of Wisconsin puts around its stadium on game days in Madison. And I think I'm interested in not planning any parking. Aren't you taking down a pile of parking to build the stadium? And that means that's, and I guess I haven't looked at the plan that carefully. And tell me it's in 180-page environmental impact statement, which I should have read. But what's the plan for mitigating parking around these?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll answer a couple and give a couple here to Vice President O'Brien. On the issue of the Neighborhood Mitigation Fund, in the budget of the stadium, in the $248 million, the university has committed, and it is in the EIS, we have committed to a $800,000 mitigation fund, $300,000 of which is available immediately to mitigate activities that impact the businesses and community during construction of the stadium, and $500,000 after the stadium that we suggested was for control of the neighborhood, that they ought to put in an endowment and spend the proceeds off of that. They can choose to go into the principal if they so choose, but we have addressed a neighborhood mitigation fund in the EIS and committed to that. On the issue of Station 19, it's unfortunate that it has gotten a little bit more press and a little bit more inaccurate press than we think is warranted. It is the case that the alignment of the road, the realignment of roads for the stadium, will require the university to have roughly 15 parking spaces that currently belong to the owner of Station 19. If I had a map here, I could show you exactly where Station 19 is in terms of the plan. We were in discussions with the, it was an ownership group, on the purchase of Station 19, and sometime in December, one of those owners bought out the other owner, and the tone of the discussion changed to where that individual did not want to sell. We were hoping to negotiate a sale. We have made no official decision about how to resolve the 15 parking spaces or the station itself. It is not needed. The station itself is not needed for the stadium. It can exist sitting there on its own. We do have concerns about what that facility could turn into. It is probably 60 feet from the main entrance to the stadium. We're obviously not interested in seeing a bar or an adult entertainment center or a cigar shop, you know, things that aren't consistent with the values of the university end up being in that location. We are attempting to work with the owner to reach an agreement for the space we need and possibly some other potential covenants, perhaps to write a first refusal if he goes to sell it, that we could buy it. Clearly, eminent domain is the last thing that we want to do, and we are committed to historic preservation. We do not want to tear that building down or see it torn down.
Ms. O'Brien, do you have further?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, to respond to your questions regarding policing and parking, the University of Minnesota Police Department has been visiting the other Big Ten campuses during games to understand the plans that they put in place during the management of those football day events. We hope we have the problem of having to manage those events in 2009, but we're working very hard to understand how those events are managed on other campuses and recognize that we have a real obligation to perform well when we have the stadium in operation. So it's really very much in the planning stage at this point, as you might expect for a facility that's scheduled to open in 2009. In terms of parking, the current on-site parking is around surface parking in the area around the stadium is around, I believe, 3,000 parking spaces. As recently as yesterday, we were meeting with representatives of the State Fair about how to manage parking for the State Fair, for the football stadium, and during construction. And we have an alternative plan, and we'll be working very closely with them to ensure that we have the same level of surface parking spaces available during construction and after construction, and continue to have a good working relationship with the State Fair to accommodate their needs as well.
Trustee Kahn.
Madam Chairman, no, there is just one frustration from the neighborhood. To hear the university suddenly concerned about adult entertainment and what's appropriate to have by the university. We know that there's that apartment development that the neighborhood desperately wanted your help to help them fight a zoning change in the city so that liquor would not be sold, and so that that the property would be designed in a way more conducive to the neighborhood. It's a property now where there have been two murders, there have been I don't know how many drug busts and so forth. But the university was very unhelpful to the neighborhood to protect what it felt was its ambiance. And so now suddenly to hear that the university is very concerned that there might be a restaurant that might serve wine next to the entrance is just a little too much for them to take. So
I think that was just a comment. I don't know, but that was a question.
They're allowed to defend themselves.
Madam Chair, representative and friend, Phil, I will take that not just as a rhetorical comment, but just an opportunity to mention that the university understands and believes very strongly that the health of the communities around the university are important to the health of the university, and that it's a very important partnership. And if we haven't always performed on that in the way that you would like us to be accustomed, we intend to do better.
I think there are no further questions. We'd like to thank the university representatives for being with us. And Representative Singleton moves the minutes of Wednesday, March 1st. Any Comments on those minutes? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Or those minutes are approved. And, Mr. Chair, are we adjourned?
What's on my
meeting is adjourned.